This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, February 16th, 2023. I'm Jeff O'Neill here with Rebecca Shinsky coming to you from bookriot.com. So all the labor issues are solved, right, Rebecca? We're all good. Everything's fine.
Yes.
Very cool.
It's just magically over. Yeah.
I guess the lead publishing story of the week is that HarperCollins and their union has reached a tentative agreement. We don't know the details of it now, so there's not much else to say. But it is, I always find this as an outside observer of these kinds of union negotiations. It's picket lines and they're bad and bad faith. And then there's a deal signed and everyone goes quiet and all it's fine. There's something about the conflict avoidant in me that's like, that's normal? That's fine. I mean, I guess I understand it, but it does seem strange.
Yeah, I think it's that everyone goes silent and then everything is fine, that those are actually two separate things, be two separate things, but they look like one thing because it goes from being very, dramatic and sort of publicly visible to, okay, there's an agreement, and then not even all the details are released. What we do know is that there will be an increase in the minimum salary across an array of jobs. We don't know what that increase will be, and that there will be a one-time bonus of $1,500 to union members. That's really all that has been addressed. The union was also making requests, demands, whatever language you want to use, related to HarperCollins increasing their focus and the deliverables around diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workforce. There's no mention of that in this New York Times piece. So we don't know what that means. We don't know if they reached some agreement about it, if they ignored it, if there's something in between and they compromised. I'm not sure that we'll ever get those numbers because this report came out on February 9th, this piece that we'll link to by Alexandra Alter and Elizabeth Harris. Longtime.
There's a shock. It's Elizabeth Harris and Alexandra Alter and Elizabeth Harris in the New York Times.
Talking about publishing in the New York Times.
Yeah.
But, it's been a week since that came out and no further details have been released. I saw some of our contributors wondering aloud about this on Slack earlier today, saying that they have noticed an increase in pitches about HarperCollins titles coming into their inboxes, which certainly feels then like there are some folks back at work at HarperCollins that hadn't been, or that, folks are happier than they had been. But it's all just reading tea leaves right now, other than knowing that something has been agreed to, and the only number that we've gotten from that is about that $1,500 bonus to union members. But nice to see some progress.
Yes, I'm glad. I hope people are happy and sustainably so. We didn't really talk about this factor as we've followed this. I'm guessing you wondered about this too. Is what actually could be codified in a union contract about diversity and inclusion? Because I don't know if people know enough about labor law even to know, it's harder and more complicated to codify something like that than you might think. You hear what I'm saying, Rebecca, about this, right? Like, you got to be very careful for discrimination reasons about saying we want to hire black people, as an example. You can't discriminate based on race and reverse racism and blah, blah, blah. Not interested. I don't think that's real. But from a legal perspective, you can get yourself into trouble unless those things are worded very carefully, or you've really consulted with labor lawyers about what you can and can't say about hiring and targets and everything else like that. So if it is not disclosed or it's not made public that there wasn't some sort of rider or clause about diversity and inclusion, I don't know that necessarily portends ill. I just don't. Yeah. I could imagine a world where someone is advised, you know, we just can't, but we'll do X, Y, or Z. Or if it seems a little weaker than you would like, it's probably because it can only be a little weaker than you would like, honestly, in some
yeah,
of these
if
places.
I had to guess, if they were going to disclose anything related to that, I don't think it could be much more than we have agreed to set targets and develop hiring policy around those targets. I don't know that they would want to publicly disclose them in a company as big as HarperCollins. I don't know if you would want to disclose those targets to all of the individual employees. You know, like we have a 20-person staff, and that's a much different proposition for us to say, here are our targets, here's how we arrived at them. And not for nothing, when you have a 20-person staff, one or two hires makes a really meaningful difference.
Huge difference.
Towards, you know, shifting the balance more towards the DEI goals that you have. But it is tricky. There's some like interesting mental gymnastics that you have to do around, like, you can have a target, but you can't make a decision based on the factors of that target. We had consultants help us develop our hiring policy. I am sure that a corporation as large as HarperCollins has all kinds of legal and other advisors helping them figure that out. So again, I would not assume that not hearing something about it means that HarperCollins doesn't care or that they're not trying with it. But what that trying legally can look like versus what you think it should be able to look like from an outsider's perspective, there is an ocean of difference between those two things. And it's frustrating and weird and fascinating.
Yep. Yeah. And it, you know, also it may not be that the first thing the union abandoned was the diversity or inclusion requests, demands, objections, you know, interests or priorities. Sometimes you can sign a contract on things you can sign a contract on, and the things you can't. So I hope everyone also cares about those things, and you can still care about them and care about them over time dynamically and importantly. But in terms of what you would want a company or a union to say coming out of this when they've made it a priority, temper your expectations about how ambitious and specific, I guess, for lack of a better term, those things can be. All right, let's do our first sponsor break and come back to some other news.
Today's episode is brought to you by National Geographic Books. So take a second, think to yourself, what is one of the like weirdest, but kind of interesting, intriguing, intelligent animals that you know of? If you, like me, think of an octopus, then Secrets of the Octopus by Cy Montgomery is the book for you. It is a beautifully illustrated book that explores the underwater world of the octopus, a creature that resembles an alien life form, but whose behavior has earned it a reputation as one of the most intelligent animals on the planet. This journey into the world of the octopus reveals how large their brains are. They occupy their whole body, not just their heads. They can adjust their genetic makeup to respond to the demands of the environment. So with this book, you can see how the octopus can change shape and color to camouflage themselves more effectively than any other species. They are cool AF. So learn about all of this and more in Secrets of the Octopus. And thanks again to National Geographic Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away With Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
After pocketing a cool $200 million for doing nothing, not being acquired, nice work if you can get it. Simon & Schuster is officially back on the market, doing very well as well, though interest rates are up, so I don't know what multiple, blah, blah. I don't really care about what price they're going to get. I'm not sure there's much for us really to dig into here except to spin out into a game of wild speculation, which is, hey, welcome to the show. If you got to pick where Simon & Schuster went, Rebecca, what are you picking? I'm assuming they're going to get spun out. They're not going to be a part of what company they are now, and they're not going to PRH. Everything else is on the table. What would you like? What do you think? And what would be the most interesting? If those are all three the same, that's cheating. You can do that, but that's not fair to me, who came up with this game. And secondly, I think it's really an abdication of your duties as a podcast host. But other than that, whatever you
want. No pressure on how I answer this question.
So much as ethical.
High expectations.
I won't be mad. I'll be disappointed.
Oh, that's a, you know, that's a solid, reliable move. I see you over there.
That's right.
I think that the direction it seems Simon & Schuster is going here, which they've indicated that they'll focus on courting private equity firms, I think that is the right call. It avoids another round of shenanigans with possible antitrust, like what they encountered with PRH. I think that I have forgotten the three questions that you asked me to answer about the three
vectors. What you would like to see happen, what you think is most likely, and what would be the most interesting?
I would like to see it go, I think, to a private equity firm. I have been heartened by the success that James Blunt and the firm that own Barnes & Noble have had with the Barnes & Noble turnaround. That's been interesting to see. You know, a private equity firm who has somebody working there or who can hire somebody working there who is familiar with publishing or, you know, what Simon & Schuster is trying to do and bring a fresh lens. That seems to be working. I'd like to see that happen. I think it would be interesting to see Simon & Schuster merge with another player in the publishing space. I haven't given it a whole lot of thought because I don't think it's very likely. But somebody, I think potentially, I'd be talking like merger, not Simon & Schuster be acquired. So now we're in the realm of what would I like to see, I guess, an alternate future. Is Simon & Schuster merging with a smaller publisher or maybe somebody that does different kinds of books, a little less commercial? And to, like, if you're going to Voltron two publishers together, Voltroning two publishers that do complementary things rather than two publishers that do pretty much the same thing, just at different scales, which is what Simon & Schuster and PRH would have been. That would be interesting. And I think it would cut down on concern about how much this would compress the market, because it's not like, oh, well, we've acquired an imprint that does the same thing we already have an imprint for. So there's some redundancy. If you can avoid that and look at more new opportunities and creative problem solving, what I think is likely is probably that Simon & Schuster goes to a private equity firm. It's clear that Paramount is going to try to offload it. They're very video focused. If there is a buyer, you know, that can give them the kind of price they're looking for, they're going to sell SNS. I think it's most likely to go to something like private equity, because there isn't really another publisher positioned to pay the kind of money that Penguin Random House was going to front for this.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you, before all this, even even before the PRH thing, I thought it was most likely that there'd be a HarperCollins plus Hachette plus Macmillan, one of the other gets involved. I just don't know that they have any confidence at all that that would get past antitrust, right? Even if they could. Okay, so it's not PRH. From a just sort of like layman's point of view, it doesn't feel like S&S and Hachette merging is the same as PRH and Hachette, because that's about PRH, not about Simon & Schuster. Right. That's what the problem is, because they're already so much bigger than everybody else. That's probably that probably is the least interesting situation, which Macmillan gets rolled into S&S or vice versa. But they're also equivalently sized after that, that it's hard for Harper to buy them, right? Plus, they already bought Workman, right? So they already took one. Hachette taking one, or Hachette bought Workman? Anyway, it doesn't really matter, except it's not a big fish eating a little fish. It's easier for big fish to digest little fish. Fish of equivalent size have a hard time digesting each other and getting the cash together and everything else like that. Right. Private equity can go multiple ways. I think Barnes & Noble looks like a success story now. By the way, James Daunt is the CEO of Barnes & Noble, not James
Blunt. Did I say James Blunt?
Yeah, just I know you knew that, but I just don't want to get emails about it.
Thank you.
James Blunt's an English musician. No, it's okay. Yep. But private equity can also go very badly, right? Are they going to strip down and sell it for parts? You know, private equity is not a monolith. Not that I'm here out caping for private equity. I'm just saying, like, it can go several different ways. It can go very badly, right? What is the nature of private equity? What do they want to do? Do they want to acquire it, reorganize it, and then spin it out as a public company? That could be possible. You know, Scholastic's publicly traded. I don't know that makes sense. Any situation which Simon & Schuster is more independent rather than less, I think, is what I would want on the whole. I probably think it's going to be acquired by private equity. If it's a stable of long-term companies and a portfolio for that private equity firm, I think that would be okay. It could effectively run what seems like Barnes & Noble is being run right now. I don't know. Is the private equity firm happy with Barnes & Noble? We don't know this, right? No, we don't know what their goals are. We can be told anything. We're hearing a lot of stories about how it's sunshine and rainbows over there, but what's the exit? Most private equity firms don't plan on holding their portfolio companies forever. That's more of a holding company strategy, which is a little less common. Anyway, I'm getting into the weeds here. But the most interesting thing would be, speaking of Barnes & Noble, they relaunched their Union Square book imprints. What if Barnes & Noble's like, you know what? We'll take Simon & Schuster. We're gonna vertically integrate. The cowards at PRH never opened their bookstores that we said they should, right? To defend against the Amazons, Barnes & Nobles of the world, to be vertically integrated so we can skip the middleman and get in front of the customer in the way we've always wanted to. We're going to deal with the cries of the independent booksellers, which I would understand. It would be perfectly natural and maybe even warranted, but we're going to become an vertically integrated book company where we acquire, market, and sell books. That would be the most interesting thing to happen.
Fascinating. And the name you didn't mention there is, how much would Simon & Schuster care about Amazon and upsetting Amazon in that calculus? Because that's presumably a not insignificant part of PRH not going fully, nearly as aggressive as they could about even just the fact that you can buy their books on the PRH website. Like, trying to get people to buy books directly from publisher websites, it's a whole other thing that I think is really an exercise in futility, and we can save that for another day. But if PRH had opened their own bookstore and tried to compete with Amazon, as we have yearned for years, would have been super interesting and a real flex against Amazon. I would guess that if Simon & Schuster has even considered that, they're probably hesitant for the same reasons. If Barnes & Noble were to buy them, would Amazon not carry any books published by Simon & Schuster, Barnes & Noble? Or would, you know, customer demand sort of push them to do that anyway? How much influence would Amazon have on a publishing company owned by Barnes & Noble, by a competitive retailer, is a fascinating question. I would love to see that happen.
Yeah, I'd love to see it for the mess. I mean, I don't know that for the content. The content would be fascinating.
The what would happen.
I think you're right that in a different, well, there's always a chance that Amazon's, you know what, we're not going to carry Stephen King. Have fun with that, by the way. Stephen King is the marquee author in the Simon Schuster portfolio. I also feel like Amazon cares less about books than they did 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Something like this 5 or 10 years ago, Amazon would have seen this as a real defense of the turf. Do they care enough to care about this?
Great question. I don't know. You know, one of the mentions that I saw in a piece about how HarperCollins is having a bad year was like a one line kind of throwaway about how their CEO attributed some of that to like difficulties with Amazon inventory. And so I don't know if Amazon is like, there's a million things that could mean. I don't even mm-hmm. really want to guess what that means, but it could indicate that Amazon is less invested in the book customer and in the loss leader that they had in books. They may not need that nearly as much as they have needed it in the past. I'm not sure. But it could, if they have shifted a little bit, they might not care as much about a publisher going somewhere else or, you know, taking some of their titles. The Simon & Schuster books are already being sold at Barnes & Noble. So it would only really be a difference of who is, again, Barnes and Noble kind of double dipping in that case from selling them.
Well, and let me be
customer.
Clear, there's a 0% chance of this happening because Barnes and Noble is owned by a private equity company. So it'd be the private equity company buying it.
This is mergers all the way down. Right.
Yeah, it just wouldn't happen. I don't know even what the value add would be necessarily. I always thought it'd be more interesting for a big publisher to buy Barnes and Noble than vice versa, just to guarantee an outlet, mm-hmm. right? Especially in more of an emote building defensive situation than an aggressive growth oriented one. It's like if we subsidize essentially or we're a part of the value chain where we can make sure that there are thousands of big bookstores across America, which for a while we weren't sure the Barnes & Noble was going to exist. Mm-hmm. But now that they seem healthy, the marginal value of that to a publisher is probably lower. It's like some piece of the acquisition price would be essentially an assurance premium that those doors stay open. Well, I don't have to do that now. So anyway, but that would be the one. Some major alignment of a publisher and a retailer would be the most interesting thing. I guess another piece could be something like another big media company, but no one's interested in this now. Media multiples are being compressed. Media is very expensive, or the media business is very tough right now. So, you know, Disney has their own publishing arm, mm-hmm. Netflix. New York Times? Like, who's got the scratch to do it? To make it as part of some other situation? I don't really know. So
something
I think private equity makes the most sense.
Yeah. Some big retailer that's not a bookstore would be interesting and also not going to happen. Like Target buys Simon & Schuster.
Dropping the bucket.
Big outlets those Colleen Hoover titles.
Well, that's the other thing with Colleen Hoover. You don't even get them all. Some of them are Hachette. Right. Some of them are Amazon Montlake. Like, that's a whole... I happen to be writing something about this right now. Preview of things to come. But if you've got a great idea for a Simon & Schuster landing place, or if you have a strong opinion or something we haven't considered, even as a pie in the sky sort of way, podcast at bookriot.com. Do you want to do... I don't know. Is there anything else to say about their sales? They sold a lot of books.
Yeah, they had a good year last year. Audio grew a lot, owing mostly to Bob Woodward. And then, of course, they have a bunch of the Colleen Hoover books. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know this, Jeff, but Colleen Hoover had a pretty good 2022.
Man. They have Taylor Jenkins Reid in her lone novel. So that's nice for them.
Yeah, that debut. We've been waiting for it for a while.
I guess going on the media's hard tip, Catapult, this is a piece by Sophia Stewart, also in Publishers Weekly. Catapult, an interesting company, and I've always had them as an interesting company in mind, but I've never kind of looked squarely at how much I admired what they've done and how unusual it is. So Catapult was, I think, started out as an online magazine that added writing classes to support the online magazine, or as another sort of value proposition, something else they could do and bring in some revenue, and then lastly got into book publishing. Is that your timeline on the whole? Is that how they got into this? Do I have that?
That
right?
is my understanding. They
also have three imprints: Catapult, Counterpoint, and Soft Skull. Allison Forbes is the publisher. Disclosure: someone we've worked with when she was at different things and at Catapult. Anyway, I know Allison a little bit. That's all I can say. Is a decent and forthright person, as much as I said. A very hard week for Allison Forbes, I would say, at this point. Mm-hmm. Were they shuttering the online magazine, the writing classes? I think this sounds to me like they've got one part of the business that's doing well. The other things are tough. And I've kind of taken as read that they're focusing on the book business part. Not that the book business isn't also getting some cuts as well. It sounds like there's some reductions happening. I don't know, Rebecca. The online content is damn hard. It's just so hard.
It is.
It's so hard.
The online media landscape of literary magazines, even harder, but really like online education, if you think about the writers' workshops, that has changed so much since 2015. Yeah. YouTube is such a source now. TikTok is a huge source. There are a lot of places and just community hubs where people go and learn from each other for free that have sprung up as this version of the web has really matured. And so I remember 2015 when Catapult was coming on the scene and knowing writers that were either taking or teaching some of those classes. MFA programs continue to be a thing you're competing with if you're doing something like this as well. There's a lot of options for writers in that space. And the more connected the internet becomes, the harder I think it is to offer something like this where you're charging money for things where people can connect often to people who are like very successful or high profile in whatever that area is and learn from them directly. It's super interesting to see this flow, you know, that they started as the online magazine and with these classes, and then in 2016 merged with Counterpoint Press and Soft Skull, which had been separate entities, and that it's been that success, like kind of an interesting case of a merger here, shoring up the business. I don't think people were nearly as upset about Catapult merging with two other publishers or talking about in the industry contraction, because they're all small to begin with. But this is a case where it probably really shored up Catapult. It might have shored up Counterpoint and Soft Skull as well. I'm sure they all had reasons for entering into that merger. But I think this is the first time that we've seen in the publishing space something like this, where a sort of publishing adjacent company that had both books and then online media folded something, and the thing that they folded was the online media.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
The backstory of Catapult is interesting too. I don't know the whole story. And I don't know what their current corporate structure is, but Catapult was founded about 10 years ago. Oh, it's actually in this piece, 2015, now that I'm looking at it, by Elizabeth Koch, daughter of Charles Koch of the Koch Industries, which, if you don't know, it doesn't matter, except say these are deep-pocketed industrial tycoon-type families. Literary magazines especially are often launched under the aegis of a wealthy benefactor. I don't know. Maybe they were tired of losing money. I mean, I'm just putting it out there. Maybe they were tired of losing money. I don't know what the corporate structure is. Someone else took different interest. Maybe this is a part of some other kind of prepping for a transaction or becoming independent or something else. But I don't know this means necessarily anything other than looking at what's working and what's not. Mm-hmm. It may portend some kind of other ownership change. That's another thing that I'm looking at here. They could be getting ready to sell it. Or to buy other things. Oftentimes before a merger acquisition of some kind, you trim the sails. And this looks like it could be that. Also, anytime a wealthy benefactor starts something, in the beginning, it's all sunshine and rainbows and we're committed to the literary arts and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know what? Billionaires get to do a lot of stuff with those billions of dollars and their interest flags or something else happens and they're not as interested anymore. This is as tale as old as the Medicis and the Renaissance of the This is a story.
Imagine one of the kids on Succession started a literary magazine 7 years ago.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we're talking about.
I would
here.
Love that. So I would love that subplot, by the way, if Shiv is like, I'm buying Lit Hub.
Or we get like a flashback to Shiv in 2015.
Yeah.
Starting her Lit Mag. Yeah. Maybe Koch Industries will buy Simon & Schuster.
That would be met with acclamation and hosannas, don't you think?
Everybody loves the Koch Industries people. And that's K-O-C-H if you're listening to us like the
K-O-C-H.
Soda.
K-O-C-H.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we're particularly attentive to this because this is the water we swim in. We know how hard it is. And, you know, online people are like, woe is me. This is terrible. And I'm sure it is terrible. On the other hand, that you started and ran an online literary publication for almost a decade, kudos.
Not a small accomplishment.
And launched and have a very Catapult, Counterpoint, and Soskull, they published a lot of amazing stuff.
And, yeah, really interesting books. And I'm glad that they will continue
really interesting books.
In the book publishing yeah. space.
When the promise of the internet, I think part of this is like the promise of the internet, of especially when it came to literary magazines and outlets, what seemed so awesome, and it just hasn't turned out that way.
Mm-hmm.
In 2009 or 2010, when we were blogging and there's things like this and things were coming out, it's like you can basically get distribution for free and you don't have to print and everyone can find you. And it just turned out that the dynamics are the same. The money's not there. The advertising's not there. There's not as many people are going to sign up for your magazine. The underlying dynamics just didn't change, Rebecca. They just didn't. It's sad. Well, it just didn't change that much.
It is. And it's the distribution piece, I think, was a big deal. And especially for like up and coming writers, like that there was just an explosion of publications that you could submit your work to. And then, you know, it's easier to get published in something once you've been published in something else. So that opens doors for a lot of people.
That's
Maybe you get your first piece published by Catapult, and that's the thing that makes it easier for you to get published in the Paris Review the next time around, or the New Yorker, or submit your essay collection to a publisher to go, you know, all out and have a book published. And that kind of promise, that did a lot for many writers. That distribution made a lot of things possible. The thing it didn't do was get more people to read literary magazines.
No, it did not.
And you have this, like, basically the same number of people interested in reading literary magazines, but then they have 10 or 20 times, maybe even more than that, as many to choose from. It becomes very difficult to compete and to get that, you know, that zero-sum game of eyeballs to come to your literary magazine. That's just such a hard business to be in. And I think, as you said, you know, earlier in this conversation, I think we can take it as read. It doesn't seem that there's any like shady things going on at Catapult. This doesn't look like shenanigans from the outside. It looks like they must have been doing some just analysis of what is working and what isn't. That's not to say there couldn't be secret shenanigans, because, you know, Coke Industries, who knows? This is a decision that makes a kind of intuitive sense, I think. It's not surprising to see someone be like, hey, guess what? We have to close our online literary magazine.
If PRH announced tomorrow they were buying Catapult, would you be shocked?
Oh.
I mean, they didn't get Simon. This isn't regulatory scrutiny situation.
I'm furrowing my brow, because what is PRH getting from having a literary magazine?
No, I mean the book group. Not all that stuff. I mean what's left here.
The publishing.
Yeah. They may ever be distributed by PRH, actually. Do you remember?
I would be like, okay. I don't know that it would make much of a difference to anybody's experience in the industry or to readers, especially.
Well, so part of this is news, but also I just wanted to salute. Catapult did a lot of really good stuff online. I read a bunch of it. I've read the books. I always want more publications doing book-related things. I think that's good for everyone to have as many players and voices and outlets working on stuff. I'm sad
to see them
go. Catapult
was always willing to have a sharp perspective.
Yes.
There wasn't a whole lot of like catering to keeping readers comfortable, and I always appreciate seeing a publication do that and allow writers the space to, you know, ask difficult questions, to write difficult kinds of pieces. And it is important, I think, artistically for literature that we have those places where writers can go and do stuff that's maybe not commercially appealing and shiny. That does make the business of it difficult to find success for a magazine like that. But they have done a lot of important and interesting work. And I'm glad that I got online at the time that Catapult was online. It's cool to have gotten to see that whole run.
Cool. You know who's not online? Indigo's book sales.
Oh boy. Hell of a segue.
Some group of hackers has been making the rounds of soft targets, mm-hmm. and they hit Macmillan. And you know what? Who really has a lot of credit card information and we could really hurt by taking their crap down is a bookseller. And it sounds like, I don't know that any of these booksellers are more or less secure or more or less diligent about having their stuff together. But Indigo's online book sales have been down for a week as a consequence of a cyber attack. Only able to do cash payment in stores. So you can now use a credit card in a store, but before that, you were like Last of Us-ing it. You were bringing your cash money in to trade it for books. What a mess, Rebecca. What can you...
Truly a nightmare.
I mean, what is Barnes & Noble doing today to say, we don't want to be next on this list?
What was Barnes & Noble doing February 9th when this happened?
I mean, this is a disaster. This piece, this is not an outlet I know much about, CP24. I think it's a local Canadian outlet, but I was looking for someone to link to. I guess it's a Canadian press. Mm-hmm. And they said the risks of reputational damage are growing. And I think that's the right lead for this.
Yes.
Like, how long can you not take book sales before people are like, I'm not going back to Indigo to get the book I was going to order online?
They quote a retail expert named Lisa Hutchison, who says, I think there's going to be some fallout on reputation, but I think that can be offset by all the things that they did do right in terms of being transparent. They informed the customer quickly, and like, that's great. Also, it's obvious if we can't buy our books on your website, what's happening, or that something has happened. That's a lot. It is a lot of reputational damage, because you don't just lose the book sales from that day or now from the last 8 days where people have landed on the website and hoped to buy something. It's probably a pretty safe assumption that most of those people weren't like, oh, you know what? Guess I'll just hoof it down to the closest Indigo and take some cash out of the ATM. Those purchases either didn't go anywhere or they went to a retailer other than Indigo. And the next time any of those people want to buy books, the next time they have an intent to purchase, will they try Indigo, or will they just, you know, go to whatever that other place is online where now they have an account because they've bought some books there already? It would be fascinating to see like stats about the impact of this over time. We won't get them, but in my ongoing wish list of things people would track and tell us about later, what kind of impact does this have? Like, obviously there's a bottom line impact if you just can't sell things for more than a week. This is hair pulling out, hair on fire levels of stuff, I imagine, at all the Indigo corporate offices. But what it looks like 3 or 6 or 12 months from now, if they have a way to determine any loss of ongoing customers from that, just really... I would not want to be in any of the important corner offices at Indigo right now. This is a tough spot.
If you go to their webpage, it's just this giant blue banner saying, sorry, and here's what's going on. Also, there's in French because Canada, which is fascinating to see. But you can't browse the store as far as I can tell. They're not even letting you.
It's
just a big banner. You can't even try. I haven't clicked around it too much. Indigo recently experienced a cybersecurity incident that affected our systems. You think so? It affected your systems? You can't sell any damn books.
That really sucks.
As the public relations czar who doesn't really know anything, but I always critique other people's public relations, right? There's nothing easier to do than critique other people's messagings and then to spend other companies' money. But what if you just said, we were hacked? Wouldn't you garner more sympathy?
Yeah.
Other than a cybersecurity incident?
Right, because cybersecurity awfully minimizing. Incident, right, that can mean something that we did broke. One of our systems went sideways and we didn't realize it and we can't fix it. I think if you are, if you're going for full transparency, go for full transparency. Say, this was taken down by hackers. We are doing the best we can. Mm-hmm. Please go to your ATM and hoof it down to your local Indigo.
Indigo said that it's changed its in-store payment technology as part of the incident response. Can't do returns, can't do exchanges.
Oh, gosh.
I guess if you were going to pick a week, probably the second week in February is the one you would pick as Indigo. One of the slowest weeks of the year.
True.
Wow. There was another Canadian company that got hacked, and it's called Empire. But just in terms of cost, it cost them $25 million, and that was after their insurance to get out of this.
What a nightmare.
Because assuming I know what's happening here, you get hacked and you're being held ransom, right?
Yeah,
I don't know if we talk about this enough about how this often happens. This is they're saying, we're not going to give you the password until you fork over, you know, Canadian dollars, this many Canadian dollars. The average cost of a successful cyber attack for a small business is $25,000. Indigo is not a small business.
No.
They're quite a large company
just
here.
Godspeed to their frontline booksellers who are having to explain this to people who just wander into an Indigo and want to throw something on the old MasterCard.
It sounds like the credit cards are fine now. You can go in there and use your credit card now. But that wasn't the case for a while. That would not have been
fun. You can't do a return or an exchange. Like, that was returns and exchanges aren't a big part of daily business, but it's something that happens every day. And people are usually, you know, trying to offload something that they don't want or don't need. And
customers are cool, though, Rebecca, when they're coming in to get their 17 bucks back.
Especially after the last 3 years that we've all lived through, people are just extremely cool in customer service.
They've got their head screwed on all the way and pointed in the right direction. Yeah, it's all good. All right. Well, there's that story. I do hope Indigo gets it.
Yes,
this is not
good luck.
This is not something you wish on anybody at all. Bad job, hackers. Let's do a sponsor break and talk about Frontlist.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I got a couple things to talk about, Rebecca. What do you have on Frontlist Foyer for us this
I've
week?
Also got a couple. You want to go first?
Sure. I read Victory City by Salman Rushdie. Amazing. Really good. I'm so,
so
glad
to
report that it was good. It's I did a little bit of reading. There's a long profile in The New Yorker. I'll try to remember to put a link into that I was saving till after I'm done because I don't like to read about the book before the thing. I don't want to get front-loaded with expectation or particular analysis. But I've been looking forward to that. But what a profile picture, I should say. This is real deep content. But he's got one of the lenses of his glasses like blacked out like an eye patch.
Oh.
And I'm so sorry that the attack happened, but damn if it doesn't look cool. You wouldn't trade it, but it looks awesome. It's a wonderful, it's an amazing profile picture. It reminds me of James Joyce and his eye patch. Literary eye patches, top 10 literary eye patches. That's something I can.
Are there even 10?
Anyway, well, we could talk about that later. So it's kind of, it feels like it could be the last Rushdie book, not because of the attack or anything. It was done before, but it feels like a distillation of a lot of the more straight-up storytelling things Rushdie cares about. It's historical fiction, but it's totally not. There's fantabulism, and the main character it lives for 200 years, and you know stuff that really couldn't happen. But he's so interested in reimagining history, integrating history and mythology and contemporary politics. You can go find a summary because I don't think it really matters because so much of it is the feeling, but he's manifestly thinking about fractures and breaks in India's history, places where there was violence, and what can be filled, what the imagination can do to fill in those cracks and fissures. And a lot of this is focused on women and feminism, like how to tell stories, how to reinsert, insert, uncover, rediscover, or through literary work itself, create out of imagination places of possibility and healing and usable fictional histories. I thought it was really, he does the world building as on the level of the sentence of stories within stories of character. There's such a lush storytelling world in Rushdie. Sometimes it can feel like almost like Pynchonian, of like too much, right? And there's some cases where it's like this, but this really feels like the right amount of, you get so much and it's so enveloping, but it's Baroque without being Rococo, to use art history. It has that lushness and that degree of decoration without feeling suffocating. It's really great. I'm so glad it's good. And I can really recommend it. I think it would be a good first Rushdie for people, honestly.
It has
380 pages, so it's long, but it's not super long. And it's complicated, but let it wash over you. Don't get too involved in this place versus this place and that name versus that name. It's myth and legend and stories and histories and empires and people. And I really thought it was fantastic. So I'm so glad to be able to report that.
I'm so glad to hear that. And I was going to ask you to speak to all the historical elements of it. It was something I had to overcome in my first few readings of Rushdie, was that, like, oh no, I am not deeply familiar with these moments of India's history that he's reimagining. And so I'm glad to hear, if you're saying it's a good like first entry point for folks into Rushdie, I think that also means that it's fine if you don't know all of the details of the history.
No.
You can go with the story.
Yeah, I don't think you do. I mean, if you some of it is so much of it is also made up or altered that I don't know how much it helps you even if you do know it very well. I think if probably you're Indian or from some of these locations specifically, you might have particular valences or levels of appreciation or interest. But on a surface level, reading is just sort of an average Joe that reads Rushdie novels. I mean, that's not the most average person in the world, but like I came to it and be like, let it wash over you, man.
Yeah.
You're going to get so much of it. And there's pieces and there's players, there's pieces in episodes that probably do mean more to you if you're more intimately involved, or it's a firsthand experience, or it's your culture or language or belief system or mythological tradition. But being outside of it almost completely, except that it's written in an English I understand, I didn't feel alienated at all. I really didn't. If anything, it had a sort of transporting effect that was really wonderful. I don't know that I would start with this if I'm doing a reading pathway. The short story collection East West is probably where I would start. I often think of short story collections a good place to start because, you know, if one is mystifying to you, the next one was a little bit of a different. You can get a kind of a tasting menu from an author in a short story collection. But this is as an approachable novel as he's written in some time, and maybe ever. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but it's maybe ever ? Is, and that's not to say it's really approachable. I'm not saying that.
No,
the threshold. We're grading on a Rushdian curve here, but Victory City. Also, listen to Reading the Glass by Evan Rappaport, which is a nonfiction book about modern seagoing vessel captaining that just came out. Listen to it on audio.
Tell Bob.
It was great. Bob, it's about, you know, the weather and jet streams and modern and contemporary ocean going, but also the history of how we discovered the jet stream. And it's great. It's kind of perfect. This is the memoir I've talked about before. Someone who does something either interesting or availably quotidian that you have some access to, and the world is complicated, and someone who does a specialized job has a lot to tell you about how the world is put together. And it has nature and climate and tech and international trade. There's no story here. It's kind of organized around a particular topic as relates to being a modern sea captain. But I really found it's great. It's The dad book quotient here is like 9.5 out of 10, I would say. But if you're interested in the world, you'll find it pretty interesting. He's clearly a book reader, very, very well written as well. So that's Reading Glass by Evan Rappaport.
That sounds loved great, it. Too.
Loved them both. Two good ones for me.
It's nice to be on that roll. I'm in a good pocket, too. Speaking of transporting, I just read The Half-Known Life by Pico Iyer. And first of all, I am mad at all of you who did not tell me to read Pico Iyer.
I told you about this before it came out. Oh, Pico. I just talked about... Okay, go. You be mad. I'm not. It's not about me, even though you made it about me, sort of, by being mad.
It's so good. I'm going to go back to like so much of his backlist. The book is about, he's a travel writer. The book is about places that are presented as paradise, but this is not like go to Bali kind of paradise.
No.
He spends time in Iran, Jerusalem, Broome in the outback of Australia, the Himalayas, Kashmir, Sri Lanka. He's in Japan in the mountains at a place that's like the end of, it's the place people go on Buddhist pilgrimages. He's in Varanasi, India. And it is just transporting. Like, what does it mean for a place and its people when that place is presented as a kind of paradise? Are we talking, what does paradise even mean? Obviously, there's spiritual connotations to a lot of the places that he's visiting. The chapter on Jerusalem, you just feel like you're like, in those spaces, looking at people of different faiths be crowded in together, both celebrating and fighting about who has ownership of them. You can feel the quiet in the mountains at the, Buddhist temples in Japan. He's asking, like, how does our pursuit of paradise change the place? It's just evocative and so richly detailed, and very like the writing itself is very meditative. I was not shocked when he reveals like late in the book that he spends a good chunk of each year doing like several retreats at a Benedictine monastery in Big Sur. Like, I get you, Pico Iyer. Do you want a traveling companion? And he's asking, like, I think at the heart of the book is this question of, does our longing for an experience of paradise distract us from the beauty of what's right in front of us in reality? And he sort of comes to this conclusion that about impermanence and about embracing beauty as it is in front of us. And one of the quotes that I wrote down was that in this vision of an afterlife, the fact of things passing was not a cause for grief so much as a summons to attention. All the light or beauty we could find, we had to find right now. He's talking about an assumption that maybe there is not an afterlife. What does it mean to like seek out holy places versus just let the happy confusion of your life, and I love that phrase, the happy confusion, be itself and find the holiness inside of it. This sort of like secular sacred is that's a pocket I really like to be in. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was going into great travel writing when I picked this book up, because I know of Iyer's reputation, but that it was going to be so dialed into a view of the world and an experience of the world that I aspire to embody, that I, I think at my best moments, like standing inside a mountain, I can kind of get there. But Pico Iyer, he's got a couple decades of practice on me, and it feels like a really great model. I really, really loved it.
That's really good.
Yeah, and I am just about finished with Sync by Joseph Earl Thomas, which comes out on Tuesday as you're listening to this show on Monday. It's a memoir. It's really good and really difficult. Like, this is one of those books that I don't know who I would recommend it to. It's a memoir of his childhood, which was defined by abuse of kind of all kinds from family and the people that he spends his close time with. It's written in third person as if it's a story that he's narrating about someone else. And that distancing, I think, serves as a useful tool for him, but also for the reader, because you can then imagine that you're just being told this story. And it is it does do kind of a transport. It's an interesting transporting thing where I have to keep reminding myself, like, this is not fiction that I'm reading. This is someone telling me the story of his life, but he's not saying I. And it would be, I think, almost impossible to read if he were. So, like, just all the trigger warnings for it. It's tough, but beautiful. And he is telling a story also about how getting into video games and geek culture gave him access to a community that was, I think, really nothing short of life-saving. But if you're looking for, like, a celebration of geek culture as life-affirming, this ain't it. It got blurbs from KSA Layman, and I think if you read Heavy and enjoyed it, this is in that space. Carmen Maria Machado also blurbed it. It feels not dissimilar from In the Dream House. So my recommendation there, if you read those books and found value in them or something like it, it is definitely worth spending time with. But it is very tough, and I'm going to have to read something like very gentle afterwards.
Yeah, I had my eye on this and I knew you were reading it, and I don't know if I can do this right now, Rebecca. This is tough, man, because it's the kind of thing I would like to read. I'm like, I don't know. And I don't like to draw a line around things or under things and say, not for me. But the truth is, my time is limited. And I guess I want to be on the edge sometimes. Do I want to be down in the hole? I don't know. I'm glad it's good, and I hope it does well.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. It is, you are in the hole with him. It's really brave, but very tough.
Just going back to Pico Iyer for a second, I don't have much. Well, I try not to get on rant raft. Well, no, it's not even a rant raft, but like Pico Iyer, did you read it or did you listen to Half Known Life? Did you say?
I read it.
The audiobook is very good of that. He narrates it himself. Okay. But once I read that, and I'd read Last Night in Tokyo and Autumn Light, the last two I only got to Pico Iyer a couple years ago, and I don't even remember why. So I went to go back to the backlist, and I did those on audio and really liked him. His first five or six books are not available on audio, which is wild still now. And there's his first one, which I heard of a long time ago, called Video Night in Kathmandu. Here's the slug line: Mohawk haircuts in Bali, yuppies in Hong Kong, and Rambo ripoffs in the movie house on Bombay are just a few of the jarring images Iyer brings back from his travels. Like, it sounds like the kind of book that Anthony Bourdain would want to be reading while he's traveling, and I want this in my life, but I need an audiobook version. And we're still not there yet. That's all I'm saying. This isn't deep backlist either. This is a really well-known literary travel writer that has like 15 books to his name, and like there's five or six of them. Like, really anything, let's see, does Falling Off the Map have an audiobook? Falling Off the Map is very good. Nope. Falling Up the Map, which is his follow-up to Nights in Kathmandu, also doesn't have an audiobook. I think A Beginner's Guide to Japan does. Nope. Beginner's Guide to Japan, that's 2 years ago, doesn't have an audiobook. Don't like this.
It's tough. I don't like that for you either. Autumn Light's going to be my next one.
Autumn Light's very, very good.
I'm glad to be on the Pico Iyer train now.
Yeah. And not for nothing, these aren't that long, which I like from a travel writing book. You want to dip it. I want a travel book to be kind of like a long weekend experience. 208 pages. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, Pico Iyer.
Yeah. Yeah. Half Known Life is like about 250, yes. I think. And he goes to eight or nine places. So you don't spend too long in any one of them. And he just really... It's very sensual in that it captures the actual experience of the senses being in those places. I feel like you know what it sounds like and what it smells like and what it feels like to be there. And he doesn't need like 90 pages per location to do that.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Autumn Light doesn't have... Maybe Half Known World is his first audiobook. Is that possible? But anyway, no one cares about this except me. I find this interesting. That's our show. Now that I'm down the audiobook rabbit hole. Here's a question. Would I prefer there to be no audiobooks of these or for there to be some AI narrator? This is when we were talking about this the other week, I should have had this, or this would have been the case. I guess I would try an AI version of Video Nights in Kathmandu. I'd try it. I would.
Sure.
Anyway, bookriot.com/listen to get show notes. You can also email us podcast@bookriot.com. We know it's James Daunt name, not James Blunt. Though it's funny to think of James Blunt as the CEO.
Thanks for saving me from that one.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I'm sure I've done millions of things.
He sits down at his piano every morning and ponders what he's going to do. What if James Daunt started giving his interviews like in the style of James Blunt songs? Actually, this is a task for ChatGPT.
That's right. Yeah, like Andy Hunter is in charge of Bookshop. It's not Hunter Biden. That would be a completely other mess,
oh God,
for sure. Yeah. Patreon, we talked about love stories last week, and then today we're going to record something weird. This is a weird Jeff idea. We're going to see how it's going to go, Rebecca. I'm not so sure. It might be fine, but we get to play around on Patreon. Go check it out, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast to see what we're doing up over there. We'll talk to you soon. Rebecca, thanks so much.